This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
After the rains in Houston, is going to come the recovery. How that might go and who is going to pay for it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Conrad Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 29th of August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. With the caveat that it is still raining in Houston and all along big chunks of the Gulf Coast, in fact, and we don't quite know yet what it's going to look like when the water recedes, people who are professionals in this line of work, disaster and emergency preparedness, are starting to prepare for the next phase of Hurricane Harvey, the cleanup and the very long aftermath. Craig Fugate ran FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency for President Obama. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
With the understanding that, first of all, this is still a developing event, and Katrina and Houston are different than Harvey and New Orleans, it seems that things infrastructure-wise and logistics-wise are running better this time. What's your sense?
Well, I've learned never to compare two disasters. They're all different. I can tell you that with Harvey, we are dealing with a large number of homes that have flooded. Many of whom were not in the flood zones where they had to buy flood insurance. So we have a very, very large uninsured flood loss developing in Houston right now.
What's going to happen when the rain stops and the water starts going away? Because that is sort of the very long tail for what FEMA does.
Right. Well, you know, still very much dealing with the active flood, but the next steps will be, where are people going to stay, both in shelters and temporary assistance, you know, hotels and motels and just about anywhere we can put in people. But more important, where are they going to stay longer term, and how do we start repairing a lot of homes, many of which did not have flood insurance?
How do you do that? I mean, do you go in with inspectors and adjudicators and figure out what's habitable, what's not, and then work with the parties down there?
Well, that's going to be one of the big roles that local and state government with FEMA supporting. But the other thing is, that, and these are kind of the steps we've learned in all these floods, is it's going to take a lot of volunteers over the next couple of weeks to get all these homes dried out. You know, the first thing we've learned about floods is, if we're going to save a home, we need to muck them out to prevent mold and further damage, so we can start focusing on repairs to get people back home.
As you think longer term and how Washington, specifically Congress, deals with this, and I'm imagining you've spent more than your fair share of time at the long green table in front of various congressional committees, where does the ball land next in terms of finding the money for this?
Well, FEMA is fortunately fully funded to respond to these kind of events, but they're going to definitely need both additional borrowing authority for the National Flood Insurance Program for that. That program is already $25 billion in debt, but they're going to probably need to borrow more money to service the policies here. In addition to a budget, raising the debt ceiling, the National Flood Insurance Program's up for reauthorization. We'll be looking at how much money both immediately and longer term will be needed for this recovery.
Yeah, it's going to be a busy September, you think, in Washington, huh?
Well, as we've watched before, there's always a lot of debate and a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of finger-pointing, but at the end of the day, Congress has always funded these disasters. So I sometimes tell people, don't look at the sausage-making. It can be pretty scary, but Americans have always come to each other's aid. But I think it's also important to note that this, because this is such a large number of homes that were not insured by flood insurance, the FEMA programs are not going to make families whole. So there is going to be a lot of long-term need, both from government, but also from donations to volunteer groups to help people recover.
When you say long term, how long are you talking here, sir?
Years. Huh. This will be years to rebuild and get people back on their feet and get people back in their homes after this type of a flood.
Craig Fugate, he ran the Federal Emergency Management Agency for President Obama. Sir, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Harvey aside, that North Korean missile launch yesterday gave traders an early case of the willies today, and then they got over it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Undocumented immigrants who live and work in Houston might be feeling especially vulnerable in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. Mayor Sylvester Turner of Houston has offered to defend himself, anybody taken into custody as a result of their immigration status. Turner and the city are worried that people here illegally aren't going to ask for the help that they need. But in the context of the national discussion about immigration that we're having, their uncertainty is not unfounded. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports now on the importance of Houston's immigrant population, documented and to that city's economy and its rebuilding effort.
Texas State Senator Sylvia Garcia is at the Command Center at Houston's George R. Brown Convention Center today, where thousands of evacuees have taken shelter.
We need to be very clear that, you know, the shelters are all open for everyone. No one is asking about immigration status.
This is a human crisis, she says, and the government's going to help whoever needs help.
The immigrant community was important to us yesterday or day before yesterday before the storm. That community will be important to us today and tomorrow and into the future.
According to the Pew Research Center, Houston has the third largest population of undocumented immigrants in the country, 575,000 strong.
Immigrants have been important to the Texas economy, both legal and otherwise.
Stephen Craig is an economics professor at the University of Houston. He says many undocumented workers there work in low-skilled jobs.
And for flood recovery, that's an important group of people for sure.
Take construction. Pew estimates about a quarter of unauthorized workers in Texas work those building jobs, and there's sure to be a lot of them once the water pulls back. Ann Beeson from the Center for Public Policy Priorities, which advocates for economic inclusion, points out that Houston is now the most diverse city in the country.
That is part of its strength and part of its beauty, and we very much want to preserve that.
By helping out everyone who needs a hand. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Tens of thousands of people have been put out of their homes by Hurricane Harvey, so far, we should say. And once the rain stops falling and the water runs off, all those people are going to get a better idea of just how much the flooding is going to cost them and the federal government. Flood insurance in this country is mostly handled by the National Flood Insurance Program, a federal program that already, as Craig Fugate pointed out a minute ago, is $25 billion in the hole. Marketplace's Rima Crace explains what that program is and why it is so buried in debt.
For the last 2 days, 25-year-old Sean Burt has been crashing on his friend's air mattress. His home in Spring, Texas is ruined with the heavy downpour seeping in.
Through my front door, my front window of the house, came in through the bathroom downstairs. It just was coming in from everywhere.
Burt set up a GoFundMe page. That's after he realized his homeowner's insurance does not cover floods.
Honestly, never really expected my house to get flooded.
At least 80% of those affected by Harvey don't carry flood insurance, says Chuck Watson of NQ Research.
It's because if you're not in a flood zone, chances are nobody even asks you if you wanted flood insurance.
Only people in flood risk areas who carry mortgages are required to buy insurance, and most have to turn to the National Flood Insurance Program, a program that owes billions to the Treasury. With Katrina alone, it paid out more in claims than it had in its entire history up to that point.
The Treasury is loaning the flood insurance program money, but it can never pay it back because before it can pay it back, there's another storm.
And the rates are not high enough to offset losses, says Carolyn Kuski. She's a researcher with the Wharton Risk Management and Decision Processes Center.
Congress didn't want to unfairly penalize those homeowners who built before they were told that they were at risk. So they've been getting discounts on their rates.
She says one solution is to actually price based on risk and to give those discounts to lower income people. It's something Congress could consider when they decide whether to extend the program next month. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Congress has some heavy economic lifting to do when lawmakers get back to Washington next week. Among the biggies, a vote on raising, or more likely just suspending, the debt limit. At the moment, September the 29th is the drop-dead date from the Treasury Secretary, subject to change, of course, depending on what happens with Harvey and its aftermath. The debt limit, of course, how much we are allowed to borrow to pay the money that we owe. But look, we've been down this debt limit road before. Will we default or won't we? We haven't. Yet, Congress always winds up raising the debt limit, and the president always signs off on it. So far, anyway. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains how we got here.
If Homer Simpson ever wanted to be Treasury Secretary, he might have some problems with the confirmation process, but he's already got one part of the job down.
Where's my money? Where's my money? Where's my money?
The history of the debt limit boils down to that question, asked over and over again since the days of Alexander Hamilton by Treasury Secretaries looking to pay the bills. Here's current Secretary Steven Mnuchin performing the ritual in front of the House Ways and Means Committee last May.
I urge you to raise the debt limit before you leave for the summer.
In other words,
where's my money? Do you have my money? Where is it?
Treasury needs that money to cover expenses the government has already racked up for things like weapons, Social Security, Medicare. But Congress controls the purse strings, and it alone has the power to loosen them. That's no accident, says Tony Fratto, Assistant Treasury Secretary during the administration of George W. Bush.
You know, the Founding Fathers, they had a very clear memory of the kings of Europe spending and putting their countries into debt and then handing the legislature, their parliaments, the bill.
That meant Treasury had to get congressional approval every time it wanted to spend money. Francis Lee teaches government and politics at the University of Maryland.
So Congress would authorize borrowing for specified purposes like the Panama Canal or for the Spanish-American War?
Lee says the process was tedious and politically uncomfortable, and Congress micromanaged Treasury spending. Then something bigger came along that made voting on every expense a luxury the government couldn't afford, namely World War I.
President Woodrow Wilson conferred with advisors, then signed the Proclamation of War against Germany.
We were at war, and Treasury needed lots of money, fast. So in 1917, 100 years ago, Congress established two broad debt limits, one for short-term debt, one for long-term. Fast forward to 1939.
By his latest act of naked aggression, Hitler has committed a crime not only against Poland, but against the whole human race.
On the brink of World War II, Congress agreed to combine all of the government's debt under one limit. For years, it worked reasonably well. Congress didn't have to go through the political agony of voting on the debt limit that often. But now spending is increasing so fast, there are a lot more votes to raise or suspend the debt limit, making members of Congress who vote yes even more vulnerable to political payback.
The basic dynamic of Congress not wanting to raise the debt limit has been going on at least 40 years.
That's Mark Patterson. He was chief of staff at Treasury during the Obama administration. In 2011, Congress came so close to not raising the limit, Standard & Poor's took away the country's top credit rating. Patterson says everyone, including the president, was afraid Congress would let the U.S. default on its debt.
And it was an extremely tense period.
But nothing compared to the shutdown in 2013.
And good morning. We begin this Tuesday with the federal government grinding to a halt.
This was some bad timing. Like now, the debt limit decision came up right around the time the budget needed to be approved to keep the government running. I won't make you relive the shutdown. Let's just say the lights were out for 16 days. In the end, Congress did agree to raise the debt limit. So, why do we keep playing out this debt limit charade? Again, politics professor Francis Lee.
The politics of asking to permanently abolish the debt limit are very difficult.
Because voting to give Treasury an unlimited credit card when its balance is already nearly $20 trillion, that would be the riskiest vote of all. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That's really what gives rise to the problem we have here, the rise of the bots.
Oh, sure. Blame it on the bots. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 56 points today, 0.2%, 21,865. NASDAQ up 18 points, 0.3%, 6301. The S&P 500 up 2 points, less than 0.1%, 24.46. Harvey is expected to make another landfall along the Gulf Coast. That leaves huge safety questions for residents, of course, also for the big companies based there. ConocoPhillips down 0.4%. Baker Hughes up 1.5% today. Plains All-American Pipeline climbed 0.6%. Houston's Sysco, the huge food supplier, up 0.2% today. Waste Management, also based there, increased 0.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.12%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. President Trump spent some time on the ground in Texas today. First stop was Corpus Christi, a couple of hundred miles south down the coast from Houston. They did all right there weather-wise, about 3 to 5 inches of rain at the port, lots of strong winds. Corpus is the number 6 port by tonnage in the entire United States. John LaRue is the executive director of the Port of Corpus Christi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First things first, what's the status? How you doing down there?
We're doing okay. You know, obviously not great, but much better than a lot of the other communities north of us. The storm in the eye wall went about 25 miles to our north and east, so we missed the brunt of it. We had winds here at the Port Administration Building on Friday evening about 105 miles an hour versus 135 or more 25 miles away. So major damage to the port and our facilities was avoided. We're really concerned that we're going to have a major flood event with the hurricane, and we did not have that.
When do you expect to be, or are you already up and running at full port capacity?
We are not. We're just working right now. We have to work with, obviously, a number of federal agencies, but principally to get the ship channel back up and operating. We have to work. The Coast Guard has to approve, look at all the surveys that we're doing and the private industry are doing of the docks and facilities and make sure they're safe and secure. And then the Corps of Engineers do a physical survey where they actually look underwater at the ship channel and make sure there's no obstructions or shoalings, and they're completing that today. We hope to have a dredging team here by the end of the week, and we hope to be open as soon as practical after that. We will be ready. Electricity, we just had a meeting with AEP, our electric provider here in Corpus Christi, and they're getting almost all of the industry back up on the electric grid today. So we're not far away from returning to operations.
Big picture for me then, as you think about your colleagues sort of up into the northeast through Houston and now into Louisiana, for the rest of the national economy and the petrochemical industry down there, what's your sense of how that's going to go in the next days and weeks?
Well, it depends on the flooding and what happens to the flooding in some of the major petrochemical industries in the Houston Ship Channel and in Beaumont and Port Arthur. That is, depending on what numbers you want to use, 25 to 35% of the capacity for refining in the United States. So any shutdown there, and right now the Houston Ship Channel shutdown, will impact gas prices and supplies in the near term. Hopefully they're going to be okay. We had the wind, they're getting the water.
John LaRue, the executive director of the Port of Corpus Christi, Texas. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
There's some new regulations going into effect for financial institutions licensed by the state of New York this week, and the way the American financial system works, it's a whole lot of companies, right? Insurance companies and state-chartered banks. We're talking cybersecurity specifically, things like companies hiring a chief information security officer, reporting data breaches within 72 hours, and having a data recovery plan in place. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains how it's all going to work.
Some of the new rules are kind of cybersecurity 101.
I mean, some of this is basic.
Cynthia LaRose is a partner at Mintz Levin in Boston.
For companies that handle a great deal of personal information, this is really what you should have. In my view, this is a floor.
Stuff like having a chief information security officer or a written policy approved by the company's board. That's pretty standard. LaRose says most of the bigger financial institutions already do much of what's required under these regulations. But some of the smaller players, not so much. And the New York regulations will also force financial institutions to ensure all their vendors, anyone who touches their data, to have this same level of protections by 2019. Larry Hamilton is a partner at the law firm Mayer Brown.
Your cybersecurity is only as strong as the cybersecurity of your weakest vendor. And many of the high-profile data breaches were the result of a hack of a vendor systems that became the point of entry into the company's systems.
Those vendor requirements will extend the reach of these regulations to companies the New York Department of Financial Services doesn't oversee. Angela Gleason is senior counsel at the American Insurance Association.
It will have some pretty broad-reaching impact. We really haven't seen anything to this extent yet.
Gleason says New York is out front on this, but she expects other states will follow its lead. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Bruce Springsteen's gearing up to play a series of shows on Broadway this fall. Tickets go on sale tomorrow morning, $75 to $850 a pop. So if you're a fan, here's the deal. You can't just get online and buy yourself a pair. Limit two, of course. First, you have to pre-register, which will get you into a lottery to maybe get a special code so you can get online to maybe get a ticket if you're fast enough. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloff looked into why the process has to be so hard.
When the boss comes to New York, it generally sounds like this.
Blew up the chicken man in Philly last night. Now they blew up his house too.
That's Springsteen at Madison Square Garden. 21,000 seats that usually sell out in about 10 minutes. This time, he's playing 40 nights at one of Broadway's small theaters, fewer than 1,000 seats. This is huge for fans and a huge opportunity for scalpers.
These are big businesses. We are not talking about the fan who buys four and sells two. We are talking about high-volume traders.
David Marcus is head of music at Ticketmaster. He says for scalpers today, concert tickets are a high-margin, liquid investment, and the traditional online ticketing system is easily exploited.
That's really what gives rise to the problem we have here, the rise of the bots.
For a popular show, Marcus says, online robots can snap up half the available tickets as soon as the sale opens. That's when you see massively inflated resale prices. But according to economist Mark Perry of the American Enterprise Institute, the bots are just a symptom. The real problem is that concert tickets are underpriced.
The artists are sensitive to trying to appeal to their fans and act as if they are making their tickets affordable so that they're not seen as the price gougers.
Perry says cheap tickets give fans the illusion of attainability, but they also give scalpers plenty of room to hike prices on the secondary market before pricing themselves out.
And that's the irony of it, right?
Ticketmaster's David Marcus.
A decision to price below market frequently doesn't land on the fan because the scalper gets in the middle.
If you had asked me 5 years ago, I would have said that Ticketmaster is totally accountable for the significant amount of arbitrage.
Christian Hassold writes about scalping at his blog, Ticket Economist.
I would have said they know who's buying. They know the names and the addresses and the credit cards, and they're not using the data that's sitting right in front of them.
Now Ticketmaster is using that data in a new process called Verified Fan. David Marcus again.
Through pattern recognition and the data we have on buyers, we can anticipate what that subsequent behavior will look like.
Namely, whether a buyer is going to resell their ticket or actually go to the show. People identified as scalpers get locked out of the ticket buying process. Marcus says Ticketmaster's been testing Verified Fan for months and cut scalping more than 75%. Scalpers tend to figure out a way around every new barrier, but for now, the company seems to be winning the latest skirmish in the ticket wars. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailoth for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which corporate America takes it one step too far. Quartz picked up on this. Cheerios has tried and failed for the second time, it turns out, to trademark yellow, as in the color. A trademark judge ruled last week that General Mills cannot have exclusive rights to, again, yellow, because a whole lot of other breakfast cereals like to use yellow, too. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 56 today, about 0.2%. NASDAQ up 0.18%. The S&P 500 up 2 points, less than 0.1%. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.